This rip of TFTC was brought to you by River. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC and enjoy this episode.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Yeah, the attack is here.
Cool.
You felt this was coming instinctually?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I felt this was coming instinctually. The situation with Bitcoin and the ETFs and the approval and Gary Gensler finally having to relinquish. I felt he was, you know, like King Canute standing against the tide. But the instinctual part here is that I really do think, and I talked with Caitlin Long about this about a year and a half ago, and she just like recoiled in horror at the concept that I think the Fed has decided that Bitcoin is part of the financial system and is a good collateralizable asset, but they want to have control of how it collateralizes, I think, the SOFR market. And it's just one aspect of how to ensure that there's plenty of liquidity within the U.S. Treasury space as things change, because the world is clearly changing, and they need all the help they can get. And yeah. So that's what I think.
No, and I said this on a few podcasts and wrote a few newsletters about it, but the haste with which the ETFs were approved and pushed through after a decade of really being stonewalled was a signal to me as well. Like, yeah, it looks like they're trying to get the chessboard set up to have this compliant Bitcoin ready to go so that they can get Larry Fink in place and others that can accumulate a large.
It could be like, it's funny about the way this is, right? It could be, as you just suggested, that it's all about giving Larry Fink access and then they're going to use it to control it and blah, 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 blah. But it could also be that there are multiple factions up there. Like, I don't know that Fink is running any, I don't think Fink is running anything at this point. I'll be honest with you. I think Fink is running around trying to get back in the game, and that Powell has him by the short and curlies at 5.5%. And, you know, if he's going to do anything, he's going to do what the Fed wants him to do, not what, you know, Fink works for freaking Davos. And he has from the get-go here. And I've always felt that. So there's a part of me that says, okay, maybe, you know, Larry, look, we can take you out, because BlackRock is not all that, like, as a company. Like, the balance sheet, the size of BlackRock relative to its power is very, that's one of the biggest leverages, you know, that exists today. They control $9 trillion worth of assets, but there are assets. Mm-hmm. BlackRock only has, what, $34, $40 billion on its balance sheet? It's a very small company when you think about it from that perspective, what it actually does or whatever. It's that amount of equity. It's only got, like, $30 billion worth of equity, right? It's not a lot of shareholder equity. So BlackRock can be taken out very easily if they wanted to take it out.
Switching cost is relatively low for people putting their money in BlackRock to allocate it for them. We saw this last year with, was it the Florida pensions decided to take all their money out of BlackRock and put it other places because of DEI and ESG.
Yeah, and same thing with Texas and a couple other states have done the same thing, right? But those numbers are not, those are more headline than they are actual real effects. I mean, $10 billion to BlackRock is not a lot of money, okay? They're not losing sleep over the fees that they're not generating over that $10 billion when they, you know, when they generate their income over $9 trillion, right? So it's a rounding error, but it's an interesting rounding error, because then it says, it allows other people to go, oh, maybe I should draft off of this or change the way I set myself up as well. I think the more interesting way to look at this is from the perspective of Wall Street itself and who BlackRock works for ultimately, who their what they're pushing on at, with their activist board members, right? Because they vote our proxy for us on the, all these boards. So all of a sudden, we don't want DEI and ESG, but BlackRock is forcing, for example, say Disney, just as a bad example, or it could be, you know, InBev or anybody else that we've, you know, been gaslit and into hating this week. But that's far outside the value of the size of the company that actually runs, that actually, you know, operates those funds. That company is very small. So, like, at some point, if you have a whole bunch of, like, American sovereignists on Wall Street just turn around and go, you know what? Hey, Larry, it's a nice book of business you got there, but we can take it from you.
Yeah.
So you work for us now, and this is what you're going to do. So
yeah,
that's, well, that to me is as likely a scenario, Marty, as any other scenario. The, you know, the evil mustache twirling Larry Fink is one version of that reality. And then, you know, the other side of it is that Larry Fink now is just another guy who had to bend the friggin' knee and kiss the ring.
Yeah. Well, that brings up a good question in terms of the battle of the sovereigntists versus the Davos class.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we in the state of the world as it pertains to that thesis today?
Well, I still think that thesis is operating. I think we lost a couple of major battles in recent weeks. I'm not going to argue. Yeah, the Ukraine aid, the pushing forward, the giving Biden the power to seize Russia's foreign exchange reserves. I wrote a big article about that a couple of weeks, you know, last week. I think those are major losses. They are very bad. And they're clearly the kind of thing that we don't want to see, actually, that bridge, that we don't want that bridge crossed, right? You know, we're not going to win every battle. And so far, Powell's been able to hold out and keep rates at 5.5%. He's had to cut QT back to $30 billion a month on the Treasury side, down from 95, but he did shrink the balance sheet by over $1 trillion. And he's been able to hold interest rates at 5.5%. Now, the numbers are beginning to show up in the economy now that he might have to cut interest rates. And I've been, you know, my base case at the beginning of the year that we would have around 3 and that the market's more terribly mispriced, factory in 7. That's turned out to be I think it's going to wind up being correct. At a month ago, before this, you know, this weekend of doom where, you know, Donald Trump and Mike Johnson both basically had to bend over and, you know, kiss the ring because they were clearly got the speech from somebody. Now I'm, you know, before that I was thinking, hey, we might even just get out of this year without any rate cuts at all. And then go into 2025 with a rate hike or two. I'm not so convinced of that now. I think we're going to see 2 or 3 rate cuts this year. And I'll be honest with you, I don't even think that changes the thesis one iota, because the original argument that I was fighting against was that the Fed will raise to 1 or 2%. And everything will break, and then the Fed's going to have to go back to the zero bound and reinstitute QE and blah, 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 and dogs and cats living together because the system is broken. So that's nice. I think you're underestimating the resilience of the American commercial banking system. And you can ask yourself, you know, when you look in the mirror, why do you believe that to be the case? Now we're here 2.5 years into this, or yeah, over 2.5 years into Powell raising interest rates, and he's going to have to cut a little bit. You know, is going from 0 to 5.5 and then back to 4.75 over a 3-year period, is that really, would you call a pivot or, you know, a Bernanke-esque, you know, capitulation to the offshore dollar markets? I would say no. I would say, if anything, what Powell would be responding to finally is only domestic concerns, right? Where in the past he would always have to, someone would have to be at Bernanke or Yellen or Greenspan or Volcker, or they would have to respond to the Eurodollar markets. And I think the SOFR versus LIBOR thesis has been validated quite well. I mean, it's a thesis or it's a theory. I hate to even call it a thesis. It's a theory. And I think it's been, you know, back tested to the point now where it's pretty good. I maybe still, I wind up being wrong in the long run, but you can't, I think, argue with the intention of what Powell was attempting to do. Whether he will be ultimately successful or not is still up in the air. Why? Because, well, there are a lot of powerful forces arrayed against him. He's just one. We watched Mike Johnson hold out for 4 months against the Ukraine aid, and eventually he caved, right? Is Powell that guy? I don't know. I don't know him that well. I don't know him personally. I didn't like hang out with the guy, and I haven't drank beers with Jerome Powell. I don't know.
You know what I mean? Like to. It would be that would be a fascinating conversation, just to sit down with Jerome. Mm-hmm. Hey, how you doing? What's going on here? You must be under a lot of stress. But Mike Johnson, yeah, to that point.
What do you drink? I drink rye. What do you want? What do you drink? Whiskey? Are you a wine guy? What are you? Let's do the thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, Mike Johnson came out and pretty much explicitly said he got the tap on the shoulder, didn't he? Mm-hmm. He was like, yeah, we were in this meeting. We found out information that I didn't have before. Once you become privy to that information, your mind changes. And then lo and behold, a month later.
I don't know if it was Mark Walk or somebody else made the point. Somebody made the point. I can't remember who it is now. So please don't, if I get the reference wrong, you know, please forgive me. But it was that, no, it wasn't Mark Walk. It was one of my patrons actually pinged me on LinkedIn one day and said, hey, I think I have an idea here, which is that, that the reason the Ukraine aid had to go through was because the information that Johnson got was that we already stripped all of NATO's assets, air defense assets, from like Greece and Spain and other places. And this money is actually just going to replace what we've already sent and has been blown up in Ukraine. And if that was the case, that's a very compelling argument as to why they had to do this. And then if you take it one step further and realize that Trump was holding out against this. He held out against David Cameron. David Cameron went to Mar-a-Lago to dress Trump down, and he had that big, you know, striding through the quarters of NATO like he's, you know, like he's actually a man with a penis at moment. And then he goes to Trump, and Trump just looks at him and says, get the fuck out. And then 2 days later, the guy who's always able to get Trump's to move is Andrzej Duda. Andrzej Duda, the president of Poland. He shows up at Mar-a-Lago, and 24 hours later, Trump's like, okay. So, you know, Trump's Russian foreign policy was very rational up until the day he went to visit Poland. If you go all the way back to like 2017, right? It was like right after his first meeting with Putin that we all like watched body language videos over. Did they get along? Did they not get along? What's going on here? And then like a month later, Trump goes to the Three Seas Summit, you know, for all the Visegrads, and, you know, immediately turns into rabid Mr. Neocon, you know, on Eastern European policy. And I'm like, yeah, something's going on here. So however the polls have been able to convince him of what's happening here. And I, of course, look at Duda as a British asset. I always have. It tracks.
Yeah.
You know, it distracts to me. So nothing has really changed. The people that Trump trusts can move him very easily because he doesn't really believe in anything.
No.
So.
No, he's very easily manipulated. Which is a shame. This episode was presented by River. River is the best, most secure place to buy Bitcoin in the United States. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. You'll be able to DCA into Bitcoin without paying any fees. You'll be able to give people Bitcoin via River links. You'll be able to send and receive Bitcoin over the Lightning Network. And you'll be able to set limit orders. If you want to buy Bitcoin at a particular price, below or above where it is now, you can set orders to buy Bitcoin when it hits that price. Go to river.com/TFTC and set up your account today. This trip was also brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Unchained is building a financial services platform for a Bitcoin standard. They have over 7,000 clients that are securing over 90,000 Bitcoin with 12,000 keys on their platform. Their platform leverages Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties.
Their cornerstone product is their Vault product, a 2 or 3 multi-sig Vault, which allows you to hold 2 of 3 keys in a multi-sig quorum. That gives you full control over your Bitcoin. They also have an IRA product, a lending desk, and they're rolling out a bunch of other products, including inheritance protocol and sound advisory. So go to unchained.com, set up a call with their concierge onboarding team today, tell them that TFTC sent you, and use the promo code TFTC at checkout. Unchained.com.
Bringing this back to Powell and him taking the position that I'm only going to react to domestic concerns, what do you think would be the catalyst for him to, what domestic concerns would be the catalyst? We had the Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey coming this morning, 10 points below expectations. Year ahead inflation expectations were above where they expected. Is it purely the job market, inflation? Is he looking at commercial real estate? What do you think?
Job market is softening, right? The jobs report, the initial jobless claims the other day came in hot, right? And I mean, this is the kind of thing that, you know, I don't follow it as closely as I probably should. I tend to trust certain people and certain commentators on this, and Danielle DiMartino Booth has been banging her shoe on the table saying that, you know, the economy is weakening faster than you know, the headline numbers are telling us. And I don't doubt Danielle's motives at all, right? I've spoken with Danielle. I like Danielle. I think she's an honest, you know, straight shooter. And so, you know, she calls it as she sees it. And, yeah, I think Powell's in a really rough situation. I think the economy is beginning to weaken in a structural way, but at the same time, we still have inflation coming back, roaring back, because oil prices refuse to back down. And now we're getting a bounce in industrial metals, and which is going to have commodity cost push inflationary effects throughout the entire economy. So we're in a stagflationary environment, which I think I called for originally, and I still think that's what we're going to wind up with. Hopefully the rain doesn't get too loud that it overwhelms the microphone. FYI, we're having a storm here in Florida this afternoon. We need the rain badly, so I can't complain. But you know, you're hoping that it doesn't hit too early in the cycles, that Powell can hold on to interest rates for as long as possible. But at the same time, if the economy really starts to go into the tank, Joe Biden's not going to get reelected, under no matter how many ways they try to prop up the idea that there's that Biden's on the right side of important issues like Palestine, Israel, or whatever. You know, that's not going to fly. So I don't think Biden wins this election if the economy really falls off a cliff in the next, you know, couple of months. Yeah, you know, he was blindsided by Aaron Burnett, of all people, on CNN the other day.
CNN, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's empty-headed Aaron Burnett, you know, trying to make Joe Biden understand just how bad things are. And she had to have walked out of that interview going, oh, my God, he's gone. Like, he has no idea what's going on. I honestly think Biden believes that the economy is doing well because that's what they tell him.
I mean, does he believe anything? Does he know? Does he have the mental capacity to even understand, even if it was one way or the other? I don't think so.
I don't either, right? I don't. So,
yeah.
So he just goes with what his people tell him, and he moves on.
Yeah. And so there's a bunch of variables in this whole equation. Mm-hmm. And one of which it's been popping up more recently in recent weeks is Japan, their inability to control the yield curve there and their lackluster mm-hmm. interventions last week. Announcements of a swap line opening up between the U.S. and Japan dropped yesterday.
Yep.
Obviously, no surprise there. largest holder of U.S. treasuries in the world. How does mm-hmm. this variable either throw a wrench in the plan or help Powell out?
I think the announcement of the swap lines tells us everything we should have always known, which is that at the end of the day, the BOJ is still the Fed's wingman, right? Mm-hmm. And that the battle lines are pretty clearly drawn. That's the Fed and the BOJ on one side, and the ECB and everybody in the ECB's orbit on the other side. So you've got the Swiss National Bank. I think the more interesting story is the Swiss National Bank last month cutting interest rates to radically weaken the Swiss franc that propped the euro up as oil prices were breaking out. And then we had the Riksbank of Sweden cut interest rates yesterday. We had the Bank of England hold interest rates stable, but the pound is clearly rolling over. It tried to hit a high of 128, which is insanely high, and now it's pushed back down below 124. Everybody wants to focus on Japan's problems, but I read something really interesting this morning on Twitter just to remind everybody that Japan can accept, if they're buying their oil and they're in the yen, right, say from Russia, do they really care about a weak yen? Like, it's all domestic, you know, it's not going to blow back on them in that respect, right? So Japan will continue to intervene as they will. I was surprised, actually, with the price action in the yen this week. I fully expected a bigger correction to the upside. I'd see the yen, we see the yen drop into the high 140s or even 145. That, because we had a 4-day weekend in Japan, a lot of people could have been caught on the wrong side of the trade, and a lot of margin calls filtered through. Didn't happen. So we're probably going to see another push towards 160 and possibly even 165. But, you know, at some point, the BOJ has got a lot of money to defend the yen with that they need to. And I just, as you started to bring this talking point up, I immediately ran over to check what the Japanese 10-year is doing this morning, and it's at 90 basis points, and it's creeping higher, and which it should be, and it should creep above. It's going to creep above 1%, but the Japanese, because there's an insular market in that respect, that once the carry trade goes away, they'll be able to handle a weaker yen as long as they allow the yields to rise. So, which is what they're doing. This is going to do it slowly. And yeah, the weather is actually picking up kind of interestingly. So we'll see how long this conversation lasts. I may lose power. So,
it's not messing up the audio at all. So at least we have that. Yeah. Because Japan has a pretty large basket of FX reserves that they can, put their hand into if they need to.
Yeah. They have a huge, FX reserves that they can dip into. And then, of course, they have the, you know, $1.1 trillion in treasuries, and they have like $400 or $500 billion in just dollars. Like, they're just sitting around. Like, they've got a lot of dollars, and they can deploy them if they need to. So the Ministry of Finance has a lot of dollars. The Bank of Japan has a lot of dollars in the form of treasuries. They have a lot, and they can spend, and they accumulated those in order to spend them at the right moment when they decided to change policy. And I think that's, you know, this, you know, we have it. I don't want to be, I'm not trying to be cruel or mean or anything else here. I'm really not. I'm just a little frustrated with the state of commentary. Everybody wants a massive, dramatic thing to happen, right? Japan is doing this. This clearly means that we're at the edge of a cliff and blah, blah, blah. And everything is a cliff. Everything is in the end of the world, right? Everything is an REM song at this point, right? And I'm like, maybe it's not. Maybe it's just indicative of a change. And that, you know, you just don't realize that it's just going to take, it's going to be a lot less interesting than you think it is. And Japan's going to spend $1 trillion and, you know, push themselves, you know, out of a lot of this mess. Are they going to get out of this with their, you know, without getting their hair mussed? Of course not. Are we going to get out of this without getting our hair mussed? Of course not. But the question is, who's going to get hit harder? And one of the ways I've tried to look at a lot of the things happening is it's like the Russian foreign exchange reserves thing. It's all a big central bank game of no, you drink, no, you drink. Right. I've been saying this. I've been making this joke now for about 2 weeks. And I'm like, I really think it's the thing. Like every time the EU thinks that they finally got the Americans, you know, backed into a corner that we're going to seize Russia's foreign exchange reserves, then very next day they come out and say, well, you know, we're really not going to do that because the risks are too high. And then the Americans don't do the deed. And then they're like, no, we really need to seize Russia's foreign exchange reserves. And they keep pushing the ball closer to the line. It's like it's like Zeno's paradox about who's going to seize their, you know, we keep inching our way closer to the event horizon, but we never actually get there. right? With this shit. And like, they all know that whoever goes first loses. And so none of them want to go first, but everybody is trying to get the other guy to go first. So, and I think that's really the best way.
Asymptote.
Yeah. It's kind of, yeah, we're approaching it asymptotically. It's one of my favorite words in the English language. Yeah. Right.
It's,
so, you know, you can tell how wet it is outside. I can't keep my cigar lit. It's really annoying.
How's gold factoring into this too? Because I saw some, I think Luke Roman was sharing charts of the divergence between central banks loading up with gold versus U.S. treasuries. Mm-hmm. Is that a move in the background of people moving first?
Oh, yeah. The big move is that, you know, gold is now central banks make up, what, 15 to 20% on an annualized basis, depending on the year, of annual gold demand. When 20 years ago, they were net sellers. You know, we had the Washington Agreement about how we're going to sell gold to suppress the price. Now they're all buying gold as quickly as they can and as surreptitiously as they can to not move price, to get as much gold as they can. The Chinese are clearly trying to be price setters in the gold market. And they're using, I think, their bid underneath the price of gold as a geostrategic weapon against, you know, at the same time that, you know, Janet Yellen's trying to continue to use sanctions and tariffs and all the rest of it. The world is bifurcating. It's moving into spheres of influence. It's everything that Zoltan Pozsar wrote about a couple of years ago. It's everything that Vince Lanchi and I have been talking about on my podcast. When I arse to actually, you know, publish another episode of it, I have a couple coming out next week. I'm actually going to record next week. But it's this, we have to realize that the gold is going to stop moving around the world, right? And if it does move around the world, it's going to be under very strict controls, circumstances where the governments will decide, yep, that 50 tons or that 100 tons can, you know, go and, you know, can go to India or wherever, but, you know, only through trusted intermediaries and all the rest of it. Gold is clearly also the only asset that the central banks are willing to use to fix their balance sheets. They're not willing to use Bitcoin yet. Maybe they will the next cycle around, but they're not using it this time. Like I said, like this, to open the show, I think the win here for Bitcoiners is effectively realizing that Tether and Bitcoin together represent a really nice marginal demand for U.S. treasuries that the Fed can utilize to help collateralize the repo markets. I think we should explore that as commentators and as, you know, forensic analysts on this, you know, forensic accountants on this. And I have a couple of patrons that have been doing this work for a while, and, you know, they seem to be convinced of it. I'm willing to throw it out there into the public and just get people chewing on the ideas. I'm not married to these ideas. My goal here is to seed interesting and novel ideas into the zeitgeist and then see what people come up with. But clearly, from a central bank perspective, they absolutely want to utilize gold as a means by which to fix their national finances. And the way you do that, of course, is you allow the price of gold to rise, but in a controlled manner. So $200 up and $100 down. $200 up and $100 down, $300 up and $150 down. You know what I mean? Like it'll be a nice, what they want is a nice controlled rise where the loss of confidence in the existing system is arrived at organically and not all at once, because all at once is bad. All at once has trillions of dollars in derivatives blowing up overnight and margin calls and dogs and cats living together and Mad Max and all the rest of it. And no one really wants that. So it's kind of a game of not chicken, but of, I guess the best way of describing it is to say, it's like that line from Full Metal Jacket. It's all a big shit sandwich and we all have to take a bite, and we're going to do so a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
And eventually we'll get rid of it all. And that's financially, I think that's what everybody's hoping for. There are certain people who just want to crash the whole system. And that's why we see the geopolitical events that we see. And I think those people are mostly centered in Europe. because they have no hope out of this. They have no way out of it. They don't have any of the they don't have enough collateral. They don't have enough freaking natural resources.
Or productive economies.
Or a productive economy. Exactly.
Yeah. Now, bringing back to Tether, I'm wholly bought in on that thesis. If you just look at what they've done over the last year alone, onboarded the FBI and the Secret Service. They just announced earlier this week that they have an official partnership with Chain Analysis to make sure that sanctioned individuals aren't sending and receiving Tether. You had Cantor Fitzgerald on CNBC a few months ago, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, basically saying that he loves that Tether's his client. And it seems like the U.S. interests are trying to position Tether as this product that they're comfortable with, which is very interesting considering how Tether started. It's essentially
A pirate. No argument there. I'm not immune to the Tether FUD and the story surrounding it, of course. But actually, if you really think about it, who better to get on to flip onto your side than the most corrupt of all the quote unquote stable coins? Because you've got them by the short and curlies, and you can flip them easily and turn them from a quote unquote enemy into an asset. I mean, this is the way I would. I mean, I put on my Emperor Palpatine hat when I do this kind of analysis, right? And I'm like, yeah, I would do that. Like, oh no, you work for me now.
Yeah, I
mean, and you're not the bad boys of finance. You work for me, and you know what we're gonna do for you? We're gonna execute all the other crappy stable coins that are out there that are competing with you, and we're going to take them off the board, and you're going to be the only one left.
Yeah,
but you work for us now.
Yeah, roll those treasury yields into Bitcoin. They're buying more than 8,000 Bitcoin a quarter over the last three quarters at least. So if the U.S. interests wanted a Bitcoin accumulation strategy, it seems like they were able to co-opt Tether. It seems like it's working pretty efficiently right now.
And it also offloads all of the Bitcoin trading demand onto a proxy for the dollar, but not the dollar itself, which is very important for, you know, having another subtle control mechanism for working, you know, for dealing with, you know, FX risks with the dollar, right?
Well, it's another, that frees up actual dollars to deploy.
Because now Bitcoin's not trading as actual dollars, where people are buying Bitcoin with actual dollars, or you know what they can trade amongst themselves. They don't have to settle in dollars; they're settling in Tether at the end of the day, right? And so you leave most of the Bitcoin trading settled against Tether to keep it out of the dollar sphere, so that you can't use it as a run on dollars, and in the real world you leave it where it belongs in this kind of offshoot market. And so, but you also have the ability to, you know, take Tether out whenever you want to, if they decide to get uppity, because all you got to do is, you know, withdraw their collateral. So,
yeah,
because their collateral is mostly US treasuries, a little bit of gold, a little bit of Bitcoin. Right. And it's a great way to, what's Tether's market cap now? Has it breached $100 billion?
Yeah, it's over 100. I think it's probably closer to 120 now.
Yeah, oh, wow. Because I haven't looked at it in weeks. I haven't looked at it in months, a couple of months now. I remember when it was cresting 90 earlier in the year. And I'm like, if it's up to 120 billion, then this thesis is even more validated than it was when I was arguing, when it was like moving up $1 billion every couple of weeks. Last in Q4 from like 85 to 86 to 88 billion or 90 billion or whatever. Now, if it's $120 billion, forget it. It's clearly what's going on.
Let's fact check that, Logan. Let's see. 110.
Fair enough.
110.
110? Still, yeah. That's a lot. It means that Tether's putting on about $5 billion a month regularly since the end of last year. It's May, right? Yeah. So Tether was Tether's market cap was between 85 and 90 billion at the end of last year. We're into May, so it's putting $5 billion a month. It's literally $5 billion a month in treasury demand.
Yeah. And what is that like?
That's not nothing.
Is it above 1% yet of overall, like, auction demand? Ongoing auction demand? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I don't know. But it would be, that's a really good point I hadn't thought of. So I'd have to look into that, but yeah, I mean, or reconsider it. But that's a really good point, Marty. Yeah. I like doing interviews with you. You're like, of all the people in the Bitcoin space, you understand all of this, all of these subtleties as well as all the subtleties of Bitcoin. I really appreciate just as an aside, I really appreciate what you do from that perspective. Because every time I sit down to have a chat with you, I'm like, I'm consistently surprised.
Well,
and in a very good way. So
the feeling is mutual. I love our conversations. Mm. If anything, just to check my priors, I think the theses that you put out there are incredibly compelling, interesting. You could see it seems like a lot of them are playing out.
It is interesting, isn't it? I make this point all the time. I just want to make sure everybody's clear on this. I don't exist as an individual at this point. I'm the figurehead of a hive mind that I've accumulated around me, and these people who I just are so jazzed to talk about this stuff all day long that we just sit there and I have the skunk works of a discussion, private discussion forum that is just, I mean, dude, it's immense. And I go in every day and I learn shit that I would never learn otherwise. And they bring the world to me and then ask me for my opinion on it. And I'm like, hold on, let me think about that for 20 minutes. You know what I mean? Before I can even answer. So,
yeah. And your particular hive mind does a really good job of getting outside of your universe and educate. I think, at least twice or three times a week, I have people in my mentions saying, hey, you got to see what Tom said about this particular thing. happened yesterday.
Yeah, well, it's funny that we are having this conversation today because somebody pinged us yesterday and said, hey, when are you guys going to talk again? And you reached out to me, an hour later and said, how about tomorrow? I'm like, yeah, okay, I've got time tomorrow. Let's do it.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com. Safe spelled SAIF. thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC. $40 off.
So how do you think all this Tether... like, what do you think it means for, like, sovereign Bitcoin use? Like, do you think they're successfully able to co-opt Tether, embed it into the banking system? Maybe it's not even Tether. Maybe it's just using Bitcoin. Do you think there's any possibility that they try to just completely KYC, AML, throw out self-custody and make it illegal?
Just so they're going to try. Yeah, I think they're going to try. I don't know that they're going to be able to. Yeah, I mean, just to make sure that we're not crossing wires, I think they can. I don't know if they will. I think Davos is trying to, like, turn this into Minority Report with more Germans. I'm not sure that they're going to be able to. Like, it's like all this stuff is up in the air. So yeah. I'd like to hear what you think about this, actually.
I think they're certainly going to try. I don't think they can successfully. I do think they can deploy a chilling effect across the industry, which they've done to a certain extent over the last few weeks, but as the dust has settled after the DOJ's actions and the response to some motion to dismiss letters as it pertains to self-custody and trying to use Bitcoin privately, it doesn't seem like it has much teeth behind it from what I can tell, particularly with the Tornado Cash case that's going on right now. They're literally trying to change the definition of what money transmission is on the go. Conversations I've had, at least with people that are connected in DC, think it's going to be very hard to actually
win a case on those merits. So that's promising. And then I do wonder, too.
Do me a favor. Go into a little bit more detail on that. I actually want to, because I'm not following this at all. I've got my head in the geopolitical clouds. So this is something that I haven't been following at all, other than what I see in the headlines, to be honest with you. So if you want to, like, I don't even know what the hell Tornado Cash is, to be honest with you.
Tornado Cash was a smart contract on Ethereum that allowed people to put Ethereum into the smart contract and get Tornado Cash out. And basically, the way I understand it, I'm not too well versed on Ethereum stuff, but the way I understand it was ability to attain privacy while using Ethereum. You would put your Ethereum into the smart contract and you'd be able to get money out the other end without a direct connection. And it was a smart contract. That's the most important aspect of this particular case, is that nobody actually controlled the funds. There was not a company. The company created the smart contract, but once it went live, nobody actually controlled who was sending money to it and sending money out of it. The contract itself did. And the DOJ shut down and arrested the two co-founders of Tornado Cash, and they're in the process of getting to a case. The Tornado Cash team sent a motion to dismiss the case on the grounds that Tornado, the two founders, actually didn't control or custody of the funds. It was in the smart contract. They couldn't determine who was able to send money in or send money out. The smart contract handled that, autonomous code. And the DOJ is arguing that so that technically the way it's set up, they weren't transferring money. The smart contract was, they didn't have control of the smart contract. Once it went live, anybody can interact with it. And the DOJ, wrote a letter back, to their motion to dismiss and basically said, no, anybody that creates these contracts is, basically, or wasn't even anybody who creates these contracts are money services business. Businesses, because they are facilitating the transfer of funds. And they said, they used the analogy literally of a frying pan sitting on a stove, and it transfers heat to the food that you're cooking. And historically, it's been very clear, and FinCEN has actually written guidance letters in the past, I believe 2018 and 2019, they wrote a few that clearly define that a money service transmission business is an entity that actually custodies and controls the flow of funds out. Right. And they have to hit a button to send the funds out. And it seems like the DOJ is trying to basically change that definition.
And broaden that definition to any kind of movement of money whatsoever.
Exactly. Yeah. And so for like Bitcoin open source wallets that individuals can download and create private public keys, and then they control the transfer of money. They're trying to say that anybody that creates code that enables that is participating in money service businesses.
But that's nonsense.
Yeah. And to my point, everybody, it was very scary when it initially happened a few weeks ago, but conversations over the last few weeks is like, this really doesn't have a lot of legs to stand on.
Well, the funny part about it is that, you know, this is exactly the kind of thing that you would expect out of the Biden administration, because, you know, when you map them to who they actually, who they actually work for, clearly they work for the group in Europe that wants to control all of that. They want to have full control of the full control over money and the full ability to decide where it went and then decide where it can stop. And a smart contract like that gets around that completely. Every time I think about this, I just think back to, you know, Christine Lagarde saying that, you know, if we have any escape valves away from the outside of the financial system, people will use it. And she was said so with a look of horror on her face. I'm like, no, Christine, that's exactly the world we want and you don't want us to have. And, you know, so I'm not surprised that you see this attempted overreach from the Biden administration. And it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah. And it seems like it's a desperate attempt to rush things through, as the writing seems pretty clear on the wall. They may be on the way out. But to the point that they're operating for the Davos class, the propaganda tactics that the Davos class is deploying right now are very interesting. There actually was a video of Yuval Harari that came out this morning. Logan, can you pull that up? It's a 54-second video, and I think you need to hear this because the hypocrisy or the propaganda that they're trying to deploy right now from Davos is laughable.
When I look at Bitcoin, as a historian, I don't like it because this is a money built on distrust. The central idea of Bitcoin is basically electronic gold, that we don't trust the banks, the governments, so we don't want to give them the ability to create as much money as they like, so we create this Bitcoin. It's a currency of distrust. I do think that the future belongs to electronic money, but what we've seen over the last centuries is that it's actually a good idea to give banks and governments the ability to create more and more money in order to build more trust within society. So I'm not sure what money would look like in 20 years or 30 years, but I hope it will be a currency of greater trust and not a currency of distrust.
Myself on mute. Talk about a classic redefinition of what Bitcoin actually is. Like, what do I say all the time? Commies are really good at inversion of words because that's their entire thing. And that's exactly what he just did. Bitcoin is the ultimate trusted money because it's money that's trusted because of what it is. And because of its bearer asset, it's as a bearer asset. There's like gold. Like, he's putting the cart before the horse. He's saying, yeah, we don't trust governments anymore. Yeah, duh, that's the point. Every time I watch that guy speak, it just makes me angry.
Well, I don't know why they put him up as a front man. Like, it's anytime he speaks, he's nihilistic and Malthusian. Mm-hmm. And I don't see how they could basically A/B test that or run like
you would think they would A/B test that with somebody else, but they don't because they live in an echo chamber.
Yeah, what's the problem when you get a group of people together in a room? Be like, do it for like commercials. Like, would you actually buy this product if you listen to it? What is it called?
Focus group.
Focus group. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They should run a focus group on Yuval Harari and people would be like,
and they'd find out, well, no, that they would never do that. They just keep pushing those same people in front of us because these people live in a very small echo chamber. The joke I've run with for years is that it's so small, it would rent for $400 a month on the Upper East Side. Right. But, it's a good line. I like using it. This is the thing. Like, they don't realize how out of phase and how out of touch they are with humanity. If he claims to be a historian, then he should understand that times of political unrest have all come because governments abused their people and the people decided to have their money go to ground. It's when governments respect the rights and the rights of people that society can flourish, and government is there to keep things from going off the rails if government has a role to play. And I'm not arguing my personal beliefs here that government's ever able to really do this. I'm not a conservative. I still am a libertarian in this respect. I just understand that at the end of the day, our goal in systems creation should always be to minimize tyranny and minimize overreach from one, of one person versus another, and not maximize it. And governments are really good at maximizing the amount of damage that they do to people. And Harari is clearly in that camp that, that humanity can't govern itself without a very strong hand having complete control over everything. And that's where he is. And that's to him. That's what trust looks like to him. That's his definition of trust.
And that's, for me, the white pill, the silver lining of all this, whether it's the actions against non-custodial Bitcoin in recent weeks or them rolling out Harari to put something like so outrageous like that out to project strength from the government. It feels like they're in a deep position of weakness. And then you couple that with the growing disdain for the immigration policies that are happening both here in the United States and in Europe, like what's going on in Ireland, the Irish standing up for themselves. And I think in Sweden, people are finally like, yo, what the fuck's going on here? Right. You see it in New York as well. They're really losing control of the narrative because everything's so bluntly in your face where it's
right.
It's no longer like, don't believe your lying eyes. It's like, it's impossible not to see what's happening.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was funny. I chatted with Michael Leahy of the Irish Freedom Party the other day. I was on a podcast with him explaining to him what I think is going on in Europe, right? My friend Crypto Rich had put us together on a podcast. And
that's the episode that somebody tagged us in, so I watched like 20 minutes of that.
And it was good. It was just me. It was me trying to you know, go back to the primitives and try and explain a lot of what I'm seeing to a man who doesn't really who gets it but doesn't have any of the plumbing, right? So I did my best there to get it into, you know, put it in good context for that kind of audience. I'm not sure if I succeeded, but you know, post comments and let me know how well I did, right? But it's very interesting to see the massive protests against Sinn Féin in Dublin as fake, you know, fake populists. Right? And that's a good sign, really, for the Irish. And I don't know. It's happening all across the board, all across the West, and to your point, really are kind of holding on by the skin of their teeth. Excuse me. And because of that, they're clearly accelerating as their program as much as possible to try and get as much of it passed as possible in order to hope that if they get enough of it done before all their agents are removed from power, i.e. in Europe. I mean, and the United States. And for example, like, how paranoid are they about the European parliamentary elections next month? I didn't really have this on my radar because I just don't see the EU parliament as being even interesting. But there is a real potential that they would have I wouldn't say a populist overthrow, but it could be in such a way that the president of the European Parliament isn't a committed globalist in one of their crowd. And they'll have to actually fight to, you know, they'll have to get rid of Charles Michel or whoever's in that role right now. And that would be odd for them. This would not be a good sign for them. They understand that their system is so brittle that it can't have any overt win, that the opposite, the populace can't have any overt wins in any lasting effect. So even if, you know, Viktor Orban, for example, in Hungary survives the election cycle, then they have to destroy Orban at every level when he goes up against them. But interestingly enough, Hungary is going to be in charge of the European Council the European presidency starting in July, right? Hungary takes over the European presidency in July, right after the election. So I think there's something there. I'm going to have to really like dig deep into this and really think this one through, but there's something going on here. They're more worried in Europe than I've ever seen them. Even post Brexit, because I think they always thought that even Brexit, they had that ring fence because they had their people in charge in Britain at the time. So,
yeah. They very well should be. And yeah, you're seeing signs of the Scottish Prime Minister step down. Mm-hmm. You have Rishi Sunak beginning to change his rhetoric. We've had some concessions on the energy side of things with Macron promising to spin back up nuclear power plants. They're obviously buying Russian gas and oil despite the sanctions.
Well, and then to find out like the report that the Green Party, the member of the Green Party that was in charge of the report about why Germany needed to spin down the nuclear power plants, that all the data was faked. Did you see that report?
Yep.
Yeah. So it was really, when I see things like that happen, like I ask myself, who let that out of the bag? Who let that cat, you know, walk around and let everybody, you know, how did that glitch in the matrix occur? Right. And you have to always look at that as kind of inferentially, as you know, evidence that there are countervailing forces pushing information zeitgeist, knowing it will get picked up by a very now very organized, you know, counter media. That would be, and I would consider both of us as part of that counter media, to then disseminate it to as many people as possible. Like, you, if I know about this and you know about this, and we honestly operate in two almost completely different domains. Right? Yours is a Bitcoin podcast. Mine is a really a geopolitics and financial plumbing or oil and gold service. That's what I do, right? I mean, Bitcoin's part of it, but it's not, but I'm Bitcoin adjacent. I'm not, right? So we operate in two different areas of the political and financial commentary space, and yet we both know about this very, very small little point. And everybody goes, ooh, what does that mean?
Yeah.
So somebody clearly knows. I think somebody clearly understands that if we put the, if they let that out into the world, we'll take it, run with it, and amplify it well beyond what anybody wanted. Right.
Well, and to that point, it seems like they're trying to really prevent people from speaking. I mean, hate speech laws in Canada, UK, that anti-Semitism bill passed here in the United States a couple of weeks ago, where it's going through the House. I'm not sure if it was officially approved, but
I don't think it's made it through the Senate yet.
Yeah,
and the point of that was not really the anti-Semitism. It was all the attendant secondary effects of the more general point of the thing that was the important point there, right?
Yeah, TikTok ban. Mm-hmm. Since we last spoke, I was thrown on a list by the Center for Countering Digital Hate. For speaking bad about climate change and saying I'm not as worried about it as the mainstream would have us to be.
How am I not on that list?
you're not trying hard enough on YouTube. It was YouTube channels only.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, what's really funny is that, I mean, Dave Collin and I, the first time I ever had Dave on the podcast, and that was literally the first time Dave and I ever met, other than like, hey, Dave, would you like to be on the podcast, right? Was like the only direct conversation he and I ever had, which was in Twitter DM where we organized the chat. And he's like, well, what do you want to talk about? I said, well, we're two old crotchety chemists. Let's talk about how climate change is dumb. And he's like, excellent. Sounds great. And then we went on for an hour and a half just going over the data, like how bad the data is, just doing a data quality analysis and how, you know, just dumb the whole thing is. I'm like, how are we not on these? You know, how are we not on every list there is, right? It's just funny. Yeah. Like,
well, shout out to Tony Heller, who's doing one hell of a job to really highlight the corruption of the data over time. He was on the list with me.
Oh, excellent. It's good company to keep, Marty.
Yeah. No, it is hilarious. I mean, just the Center for Countering Digital Hate is laughable how weak they are. Right. They have to spin up this NGO. What is like, what the hell is digital hate? And you're going to give a list to YouTube and say that you should censor these people because they have opinions about climate change.
Well, what's really funny is that I actually look at that as a very good thing, because I look at how much money they have to spend to spin up the NGO, and then they have to staff it, then they have to, and it's all money wasted, right? It's all really wasted money. And so they're spending, it's like the argument, when I think about something like that, it reminds me of my arguments about the myth of policing, that policing as a tool is an intimidation tool where you arrest one person to cow 1,000 people. And that, but once you get to a point where you have to have more cops than there are people, then the whole system collapses, right? Because you can't, if you have too many enforcers, then you don't have enough money, you don't have enough of a productive economy to support all the enforcers. And then the checks stop and the whole thing really collapses. And so if they keep spinning up all these NGOs, I'm like, ooh, good. Keep spending George Soros's money. Keep spending all these euro dollars that Jerome Powell is drying up at 5.5% around the world. Like, spend your money. Go ahead. You're going to run out because we ain't making more of them. That's the key to understanding why what Powell has done has been so monumental, is that he really has dried up so many of the nefarious funding channels. There's still plenty of them out there, and the British Crown still has unbelievable amounts of money in offshore, you know, tax havens and all the rest of it. But they're now spending seed corn. They're not spending leveraged up, crappy, shitty euro dollars they're not spending the interest on their crappy euro dollars and the CLOs and all this other, you know, crap. They're not doing that anymore. They're not having to actually spend M0, not M3. You know what I mean? Yeah. to maintain this. And that's a good sign.
Which acutely highlights why we need sound money back in the world. What enables them to do all this terrible shit? It's this easy money.
Right. And I don't care what that sound money looks like. I'm agnostic. I'm agnostic whether it's going to be gold or Bitcoin or some version thereof. Like, I'm not, you know, I get a lot of hate from the Bitcoin evangelicals. I guess this is better than calling them the Bitcoin maxis, because then maybe there's a fundamental difference between those two sets of people. But like, they don't like, I'm my critiques of Bitcoin are not, you know, kind of IQ 105 midwit arguments about Bitcoin. They're very, very nuanced, specific, intellectually rigorous arguments about Bitcoin that are based on the fundamental truth that no technology is the end all and be all of a particular thing, because human beings are still, and their needs are always evolving. Bitcoin may be the next thing, but it won't be, it may or may not even be the last thing. It could be. I sincerely doubt it, but it could be. And even if it isn't that, if it is the thing that drives helps drive a massive reorganization of global capital handling and back towards decentralization of property rights, then it doesn't have to do any more than that. It can just be one of the things, the tools in our toolbox to regain our sovereignty as people. And that's good. And isn't that good enough?
That's a massive success.
Exactly.
I mean, that was one of the core points at the end of the Bitcoin Standard by Safe, was if the only thing that Bitcoin does is force central banks to bring sound money back to the world, it is a massive success.
Massive success. Let me put it to you this way. One of the things, I mean, for example, Martin Armstrong has made the argument for a long, long time. And again, I'm not endorsing Martin's argument here, but I am going to riff off of it. Okay. Which is the following. He said, look, you know, Martin's opinion is all, the original conception of the Federal Reserve wasn't wrong. It was there as a thing to provide elastic money in times of illiquidity for the banking system so that we didn't have a massive deflationary collapse, that the Fed was there as the lender of last resort on a regional basis, the 12 member banks on a regional basis to keep the banking system solvent during crisis periods because of the natural vagaries of the boom bust cycle. If from that perspective alone, it's hard to argue with Marty. Okay. If we take the Fed as it exists today and we go from where we are today to back to that, that would be a massive win. It wouldn't be the win, right? But it would be a great win in the battle. I'm not, you know, again, this is not an endorsement of the Federal Reserve, but let's just play that out. Wouldn't you? It's like thinking to yourself, okay, if you are a hardcore Austrian sound money kind of guy and you were running the Federal Reserve right now, how would you operate monetary policy? Would you just be, you know, would you just be like the guys who run for dog catcher in BFE Texas and say, I'm running as dog catcher in BFE Texas to abdicate the job and take it off the books? No, that would be unbelievably disruptive and destructive to the entire world, because the world, sadly, you can argue sadly, is, you know, operates within this paradigm and this framework of central banks. So, like, I'm not saying that the central banks are reformable, but if they want to survive, they may have to go back to a much more humble role in the economy. And wouldn't that be a good thing? And if I were Fed chair, for example, I'm having a hard time believing that I wouldn't be running the Federal Reserve right now the way Powell is, setting up, you know, a domestic debt indexing rate and setting up a domestic banking system that pushes us back towards regional banking and net interest banking and all and classical, you know, what banks are supposed to do, as opposed to the casino that they've been turned into. That's what I would do. That would be my step one along in the way of getting rid of the Fed, for example. right? But I have to, like, order of operations matters. I've been said this for years. So this is just, again, it's not an endorsement of the Fed as an institution. It's just like, how do we go from where we are to where we want to go? And what steps do we take along that path? And I thought about this a lot, and I thought about this a tremendous amount. And I'm like, yeah, that whole libertarian Hippocratic Oath thing is very important. Like, do as little harm as possible while you're unfucking the world, basically.
Yeah, and that path is a harrowing path with a bunch of needle threading. I think that's the scary part. Is,
of course it is. It's
a virtuous goal and path to try to take, but has the Frankenstein that's been erected so fucked up that it's
yeah, like I don't have an answer for that. Yeah. I'm saying this is what I would try to do with the imperfect knowledge that I have in front of me and with the imperfect tools that I have. That if I were Fed chairman looking at with my tools that were in my toolbox, I'd be like, I don't know if I can pull this off, right? But I'm damn well going to try, and I'm damn well going to fix what I can fix, and then hopefully, if I can get enough buy-in from the rest of the world to work through the process constructively, we can get there if we make that decision. If the people, however, who erected that system for their own benefit refuse to give up that power, which you have to expect that they won't willingly, then does the world not kind of look like what we have today, right now?
Yeah.
And aren't we in the middle of it? I can make that argument very, very, very compellingly. And, you know, you can choose to say that I'm full of shit. That's fine. Like, I'm okay with that. But I happen to think that that's where we are. And there's a lot of compelling evidence to think it in those terms. And maybe I don't have the whole picture in my head. Maybe there is a different way of looking at it that I haven't considered yet. I'm happy to have somebody put that on the table for me. But I know damn well it ain't peak oil. As the driver,
I saw you go. Who were you going? Who were you fighting back?
I was going off with Steve Santangelo. He poked a fight he should never get into with me. He's done this two or three times, and he shouldn't do it. So,
peak oils. They've been fear mongering about peak oil since the '70s.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, my issue with the EROEI guys, and I'll make this very, and this is analogous to Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is an energy based money, right? Just like gold is an energy-based money. You know, gold is just, you know, congealed diesel fuel, right? I mean, at the end of the day, or human labor, or, you know, shovels and picks and shovels, or whatever you want to call it. I'm getting passed from satellite to satellite on Starlink, so if it's a little fuzzy right now, it's
the audio is fine. The video is a little fuzzy, but
the audio, but yeah, the video is terrible. It's terrible on my end. So, but one of the things to discuss, and I know I think I discussed this with Dave Collum as well at one point when we talked about peak oil, is like, look, they're focusing on the enthalpy version of part of the problem. You put mechanical work in to get mechanical work out. Hold on for a second.
Holding.
Okay. Like, one of my dogs is, you know, letting me know that there are new people here working on my property. But the Gibbs free energy equation has both an enthalpy and an entropy component to it. And what that means is that just because we burn a lot of oil, Goober, that's enough. Just because we burn a lot of oil, Goober's a great dog, by the way. Just because we burn a lot of oil to run our economy doesn't mean that's all we use oil for. There's a lot of oil is used in a lot of value-added products up the chain that drive a lot more profit than just taking the oil out of the ground, cleaning it up, turning it, you know, fractionating it, and then turning it into diesel fuel, JP4, gasoline, and all the rest of it. There's all sorts of things we do with oil. And that generates a tremendous amount of profit, and that's on the entropy side of the equation, part of the equation. And they ignore that because they want to ignore it. It's a willful suspension of it's a univariate analysis about what oil is and what it does, as opposed to, and it's the same thing I have a problem with, again, with the Bitcoin fundamentalists who have the same argument about what Bitcoin has to do, right? It's the same kind of thing. They're saying we don't have the ability to respond to incentives as people, come up with better technology either to extract oil that's currently non-economic, or come up with competing technologies, energy technologies, thorium molten salt, for example, or Gen 3 uranium or whatever, all these other things for generating electricity and mechanical advantage. There's all sorts of other options here, right? And you can't just look at one aspect of a market. You have to look at the entire thing. Because if that were, and that's where the price of oil in inflation adjusted terms destroys the whole EROEI argument. You know, you go back to the 1970s and you go and look at the price of oil and you use the CPI and you go back to the early 1970s and you calculate what the price of oil was in inflation adjusted dollars versus today. And it's like a 15% increase, maybe 20%, you know, at $85 or whatever it is. It's not enough for me to get upset about. Even if our EROEI has dropped from 100 to 1 to 5 to 1 or whatever the hell it is, it's dumb. There's so many other avenues here. And if anything, that's stopping us from shifting more of oil demand away from burning oil to using it as a materials precursor, it's only because governments are in the way stopping us from doing so.
Yep.
Like, and we're not allowing the natural investment cycle of those barrels of oil into new technologies to give us new options as people, be it, you know, natural gas and, you know, hydrogen fuel cells or thorium molten salt or, you know, Gen 3, Gen 4 uranium 238 reactors or whatever. Like, there's all sorts of other technologies that are out there for energy. And I'm like, you really think that this is the end all and be all of energy, and that tomorrow we're going to like go over a cliff and we're all going to go back to the Stone Age? I'm like, really? Like, dude, we got four X-class CMEs just like popped off the sun, and this might be the last interview you and I ever do. Right. Right? Like, that's a cliff you should be worried about. Speaking of which, we got another cigar.
They should be hitting, like, why not? They should be hitting the earth like today and tomorrow, right?
It's a big deal. Like, so, you know, part of the other thing is to remind everybody, hey, at the end of the day, let's have a nice, calm conversation about all these things, because, you know, we're all on edge and we're all anxious and on edge because we can feel them trying to meme us into World War III, and there's all these things are happening, and then we're getting, you know, bombarded with X-class, you know, X-rays and high energy particles from the sun in ways that we've never been bombarded by before. There's all these things have changed. And we have to realize that, you know, we're not nearly as rational as we think we are. We're just not. We're kind of irrational ultimately as people. So we should really just, you know, take a step back, be a lot less hubristic about what it is we think we know, and just keep playing ideas out as best as we can. And, you know, and don't pick fights with people that, you know more than you, because it's never a good idea, especially in public.
Yeah, imagine what would happen if the government wasn't subsidizing all this other energy exploration, corrupting the pricing mechanism for exploration.
And like all this oil that's out there that we could go grab, you know, in Canada, or all the, like, there's so much oil out there. There's so much natural gas. I think this morning, I think on Twitter, somebody posted up a list of the major oil discoveries in Africa over the last 3 years. In response to this Twitter thread that I got into yesterday with the peak oil guys. And I'm like, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, it's not high enough recovery. Yeah, it is. If we need it to be, it will be, or we will figure something else out and we'll fire up the nuclear reactors and we'll make new ones. And we can do this. We can remove all the permitting stuff that's in it's like 10 years to build a new nuclear reactor in the United States is a function of regulation and permitting and bureaucracy. It's not a measure. It's not because we don't know how to build nuclear reactors. That's just dumb. We can do this if we want to. If it's that acute, if the need is that acute, we as people can do it.
Yeah.
And we've proven in the past that we've done it. We've built this society to this point. We can continue going. And if you don't believe in the law of diminishing marginal utility, well, then you're a Malthusian, and ultimately you're a communist.
Yep. Yuval Harari at the end of the day.
Yes.
Yeah. Factor in like Guyana, low-hanging fruit, just go in and get the communists out of Venezuela and clean up their right. extraction process. Like there's, I'm not worried about peak oil.
There's so many, like the Russians are pulling oil out of the ground and, you know, and yeah, you know, even Steve this morning came up and said, well, if Russia was, you know, why isn't, aren't they drilling deep wells anymore when they're drilling now like 48% of shallow wells? Because the shallow wells are cheap and they finally got access to the technology because we kept it from them for 40 years. Yeah. Like we hoarded our fracking technology as a strategic asset from the DOD and wouldn't export it for years, decades. And some of it leaked out, you know, and, you know, with the joint ventures that the Russian oil companies, you know, formed with like Shell and Gazprom and Exxon and others, they taught the Russians how to do this stuff. And now they're doing it. Why? Because these wells are cheap to spin up, not because they're the only option.
They're desperate.
Like, yeah. I don't believe in false dichotomies, Marty. You know that. To me, everything is a multivariant problem to be solved. And, you know, it's, you know, and anybody who tries to reduce everything to a single variable, invariably, you know, you get what you measure. If you only measure one variable and then slot in, as my partner Dexter White likes to say, you build a model in Excel and then you take it and you slide the model, the slider on the model all the way to the right and boom, you know, the world blows up. Well, yeah, but that's not the way we operate. We respond at every step along the way and we alter our behavior as a measure of incentives because our incentives change at every price point.
Yeah, right. That's one thing I've learned working in the Bitcoin mining industry for 6 years is mm-hmm. Throw the Excel models out. Mm-hmm. Nothing will ever map to them.
No, they don't. They don't work. Like you have to like it. This is where someone like Martin Armstrong, whether you believe in Socrates or you don't, is irrelevant. Martin's overall thesis, his contribution to society, and it's a profound one, is that everything is cyclic. It is what Marty's talking about when he says things like that is literally the law of diminishing marginal utility writ large. And what he's trying to do is, you know, build models that predict how we're going to respond to changing environments by looking at all these different variables at the same time and then solving a whole bunch of differential equations. It's an ambitious project on his part. I don't know if he's cracked the code or not. I don't even care. I just know that what he's taught people elementally in this zeitgeist of everything is either we live in an if not A then B environment. If you're not a gold bug, then you love Bitcoin. If you love Bitcoin, then you hate gold, or, you know, all these. If you don't side with Israel, you love the Arabs. If you're against government education, you hate children. Like all this bullshit, right? What Marty's saying is, nah, it doesn't work that way. Everything responds to everything else and everything, you know, and we respond to a complex system of incentives and feedback mechanisms. And yes, all with imperfect knowledge, but that's the nature of the universe. And, you know, you should always be humble in the face of your own ignorance.
That's a beautiful thing too.
Yeah, of course it is.
It's, completely co-sign that, be humble. Just ride the wave. As somebody who surfs a lot, that's one thing you learn surfing. The ocean's not very predictable, but you
get I can only imagine. I've never been on a surfboard in my life.
It's a lot of fun.
I'm sure it is. The only time I ever really worked my legs hard was when I was doing martial arts. And spar with people. And
surfing is all shoulders. It's all shoulders.
Is it?
And the balance.
Oh, yeah, I guess
you
so.
Your core and shoulders. So.
Neither of which I have ever had strong shoulders or strong core. So yeah, I would get on a surfboard and then I would drown and the board would be in the Bahamas and it would be bad. I'll just stand on the shore and watch you surf and walk through the edge of the walk along the beach and work my calves out as I walk through the wet sand. That'd be enough for me. Smoking a cigar the entire time.
It's not a bad way to spend your day on the beach. I'm not going to lie.
No, really.
I know you just said we shouldn't focus on individual variables, but before we wrap up, that's one. Sure. There is one variable I'd like to touch on, and it is Jerome Powell. What is his future at the Federal Reserve? What are his potential futures at the Federal Reserve? Do you think they keep him around?
You know,
I think Powell is, I don't think he's going to go for another term. I think he's about 71 years old now. I think Danielle has made it, you know, has intimated quite explicitly that he signed up for the second term, even though he didn't need to. He's, I think, a man on a particular mission to reform the Fed at a particular, in a particular way, to make it a domestically focused institution, knowing that the age of the dollar global reserve currency is over. And he's trying to set it up in such a way that the impact of that change on the United States is as minimal as possible. And he's fighting a political class, and that would include Donald Trump, by the way, who don't believe in that, who don't agree with him and are fighting him all lock, stock, and two smoking barrels.
Didn't Trump come out and say he wants to control interest rates?
Yeah, of course he does.
Is that a rumor?
Yeah, Trump is a mercantilist. He believes in strong protection tariffs and a weak currency. He's a Marty. I've been saying it for years. I like Trump, but he's just a shitbag property developer from Queens.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's who he is at his core. And he was trained by mob bosses, Roy Cohn and others, to how to negotiate and how to do the thing. And he would, and what scares me about Trump is that the wrong people will be, he will be surrounded by the wrong people that will allow him again to force the unwinding of everything that Powell has done. That is my biggest worry at this point. And the rumor that I saw the other day that he was going to choose Marco Rubio as his running mate should be the most chilling piece of news of the week, because what that's saying is, oh, we're going to have our Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush moment, where if Trump steps out of line, they'll just kill him and install little Marco, who they fully control. And that's not a good sign. I don't know how true that is. I just know it's a rumor. I'm still hoping against all hope that he does the right thing and chooses Tulsi Gabbard, because she fixes every one of his deficiencies as a human being and bridges the gap between the left and right on Israel, I think, in a way that is reasonable, minus the histrionics of all the libertarians who are screaming that, you know, she's bought into the ridiculous, you know, Islamist, evil Islamist caliphate argument. I don't see Gabbard as that person. I think she's right in that respect, that there's a sect of Islam that even Muslims are horrified by and would like to see go away. And I think Hamas represents that. And I don't see her as, you know, pro-Israel in this respect either. I think she looks at the entire thing and says, it's all bad. We've created it and it needs to be dealt with. The other day, I think if you really were to press Gabbard on these points, and I may have to sit down and read her book just to find out what she's actually saying on this point. Maybe I actually will do that. But you know, the other day I was doing my twice weekly podcast for my subscribers, and we've been talking about this a lot. I just literally posted an article, the first half of an article that, about all of this stuff about Israel, the protests, and, you know, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. I published the first part of it today. I wrote a proto version of that article last week for my subscribers. So we've been just discussing this in very controversial terms now for a little over a week. I was on with Tommy Kerrigan the other day trying to explain some of this stuff, and I'm working through these things. But the other day I was thinking about it and I said, you know, in the midst of all of this stuff that's going on, Benjamin Netanyahu publishes his plan for what to do in Gaza post Israel's wiping out of Hamas. Whether you believe that they can wipe out Hamas or not, that's not what this is about. I'm not endorsing this plan. I'm just saying Netanyahu has a plan for the future. And that plan for the future is to wipe out Hamas, get the Palestinians to submit, and then bring them into the fold within a greater Israel so that everybody can coexist. Okay? I think it's a little weird. Even my Israeli friends who are like, you know, who are not pro Netanyahu in any way are like, this feels odd. And then I thought about it for a minute and it reminded me of what Putin did in Chechnya when he leveled Grozny. And again, I'm drawing a parallel here. I'm not in any way, manner, shape, or form condoning anything that's going on. Okay. I am drawing a parallel. In 2008, during the Second Chechen War, when Putin went in and leveled Grozny and got the separatists under the elder Kadyrov to submit, the terms of the surrender were that you surrender, you submit, you pledge loyalty to Russia, and we will rebuild Grozny better than it was before, and we will allow you to self-govern. And as long as you don't ever take up arms against Moscow ever again, we're cool. Govern yourselves however you want. To this day, and today, Chechnya is in a much stronger position than it was before the wars. Putin has been as good as his word. The younger Kadyrov, Ramzan Kadyrov, as absolute Goober. Damn it. Sorry.
That's fine.
The elder Kadyrov is now one of Putin's strongest allies within Russian politics. He was there at the, you know, at Putin's inauguration and at the May 9th celebration for their victory in World War II, and talked glowingly about how they're going to, you know, bring Ukraine back into the fold, and how Putin is going to, you know, I mean, Putin has disarmed Chechnya in that way, and it's working. And now he has some of the most staunchly loyal people on his side. Chechnya voted like 99% for Putin. The other 1% didn't show up. And remember, it was Kadyrov's Chechens who were the ones chomping at the bit to go into Mariupol and do the bug hunt to wipe out the Azov battalion that was holed up in the Azovstal steel plant in 2022. Those guys couldn't wait to prove their loyalty to Putin. Now, I'm not saying that Netanyahu is going to create that same situation in Gaza with the Palestinians. That is not what I'm saying. But it certainly seems like that's the plan he's putting forward here. That there will be no two-state solution. He's always been against that. I don't trust Netanyahu as far as I can throw it. But I throw these ideas out there for you to chew on. Not because I endorse them, okay? These are, you know, at some point, something has to be done to deal with the animals and the crazies that we've created for cynical geopolitical reasons. And they need to be dealt with, just like ISIS, just like Al-Qaeda, and all of it. And, you know, I don't have a good answer for this, but that may be one of them. Like, history is pretty clear that conflicts like this always end bloody. But if they're going to be bloody, then they need to be definitive. They can't be allowed to fester. And the people who we're all fighting against want these conflicts to never be resolved, because then they can be spun up at a moment's notice to gaslight people, divide them, get them screaming at each other while they, you know, erect another part of their big technocratic, you know, awful system that they have a plan for, that they want to put in place. And I think we need to remind ourselves that there's always a bigger, that everybody's a pawn, everybody's engaging in propaganda, and everybody's a victim.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and that's the thing that just, you know, and I find myself now caught in the middle between these two sides. I don't endorse Israel. I don't endorse Hamas. I don't endorse any of these freaking people. But I look at it and I say, oh, well, we got Jews to the left of me, Arabs to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you. Or in Europe, I've got frogs to the left of me, limeys to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you. I got, you know what I mean? I've got Nazis to the left of me, Ruskies to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you. Like, it's the same. This is what narcissistic abusers do. They triangulate between people and they get them against, and they set them against each other while they get off on it and they use it to their advantage. And we have hundreds of years of history showing us who those people are.
and they're really good at it.
Well, this makes me think, like, how much of a generational aspect comes into this? I'm 32, child of 9/11, wars in the Middle East, great financial crisis, obviously. Mm-hmm. 2020, COVID. Now you pair all that with the economic stress that everybody in my generation and the generation coming up is feeling. Like, how much of all this is, and now that we live in the information age, we have shows like this and yours. Again, white pill. I'm trying to focus on the white pills, silver linings recently. Right. Like, I think there's a generational aspect where, like, people my age are like, we're done with all of this. Like, we know that you're trying to manipulate us and divide us. Not all of us, obviously, but I think a strong enough intolerant minority, at the very least, is being able to identify that everybody's being manipulated. And again, it seems like their game's just overplayed. Like, you can sort of piece together the their way of operating, their modus operandi, and identify it as it's happening. Yes. Like, you see it. It's literally, they couldn't even wait 4 years. Good at it now. Election year, it's like protest. That's throughout bird flu. And everybody's like, we're not falling for this again.
You mentioned that you're 32 years old. Which by the way, is phenomenal, by the way, that you're in this state of awareness at that age. I didn't even start to become politically aware or even like try to dial in until I was 32. Okay. Like, I was like, nope, this is all just shit. And they all suck. At 32 is when I took the world's smallest political quiz for the first time. I went, oh, I know what my problem is. I'm a libertarian. Like, literally, it was like overnight. I'm like, oh, that's what my problem is. I literally went home. I said, honey, I know what our problem is with politics. We're libertarians. And she went, oh, okay, that makes more sense now. And we were just completely out of phase with the world because we looked at it and we said, well, we can't change any of this. But then it's been a long, slow, hard grind over, I'm 56 now, so it's 24 years of me piecing these things together and getting better at it over time. And, you know, my instincts were that it was all bullshit, but I didn't have any good context for it. I didn't study history. I studied chemistry and literature, right? And so over time, I've just had to become, you know, I've just pieced it all together slowly but surely, you know, through monetary theory and, you know, politics and this. And then eventually that's where we are, And if I wouldn't even be where I am right now if I didn't become, I didn't move into the public sphere to be able to sit down and have conversations like this with the world, right? You know, I just remember being the guy shouting at the walls of my house and everybody looking at me like I had four heads. They were probably right, you know.
No, and that's the thing I think people really underestimate is the power of these conversations, and not only this conversation, but tens of thousands, millions of conversations happening, whether it's in a closed Patreon, Discord server, Slack group, broader shows like this get released publicly. These conversations are happening. Everybody has that deep down intuition, like something's fucked up. They're fucking with us. And
think about think about the huge effect that Joe Rogan has had on the ability for people to just sit around and shoot the shit for 2 hours and have everybody go be in rapt attention about anything. Yeah. And it's amazing. Yeah. It really does break through the whole tightly controlled, soundbite driven, you know, what I like to call the old British media model of what's the word I'm looking for? Propaganda is obvious, but it's that, you know, it's that sensationalist nonsense and then spin the narrative, and their narratives don't last 24 hours anymore.
No. So, and that's going back to like Martin Armstrong's cyclical thesis. Like, it feels like we are at the end of a cycle entering into a new one. And
yep.
If you believe Neil Howell's, what's he called?
The fourth turning.
Fourth turning. Yeah. We're in the fourth turning.
Yeah, there's like Neil Howe, Strauss and Howe, the Kondratieff, Martin Armstrong. Armstrong says we're in the cycle of cycles, that the end of a cycle of six cycles, right? He has a whole thing that way. When you look at what's happening within the sun, you realize that there's also, we're coming to the end of a whole bunch of different major solar cycles as well, and what the earth is doing in relation to it, and blah, 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 blah. All these things are coming together. And I don't, the older I get, the more I'm like, yeah, you know, maybe astrology isn't woo-woo, you know, maybe this isn't, you know, like this, like as people, I say this all the time, and you know, I know we have to go soon because I've got another show in a couple of minutes, and I need to recharge. But all stories are metaphorically true, and all stories are false, right? All stories are not true. They're all just things that happen that are then filtered through our consciousness, and then we communicate to somebody else, and that's what the story is. And the story is your version of the truth. But at the same time, all those, and that the stories may be, you know, may not be literally true, like the story of Homer and, you know, of the Odyssey or the Iliad or the stories in the Bible or Star Wars or this or that or any of these big freaking stories. But what they all are metaphorically true in order to try and tell us what happened in the last crisis period and how we dealt with the last crisis in order to inform the next generation, you know, to how they're going to better be informed to handle the next crisis. That's what these stories are for. And we have to, you know, and the stories we're telling right now are the ones that we're working through the real issues that we're feeling, be it intuitively or intellectually or a mixture, hopefully a mixture of both. That's the real important part. So, and I'm on the side of Ian McGilchrist. If you don't know who he is, the left brain, right brain guy, I mean, McGilchrist is brilliant. And he's firmly convinced that what we have now is a fight between models and reality, between the left brain and the right brain. And we are a left brain dominated society that has lost its ability to interface with, you know, reality, that the left brain builds models, the right brain sees reality. And, you know, the problem with the left brain is that the model can overcome the reality and shout it down and then keep it suppressed. And in the world we've built for ourselves, we're reinforcing left brain model making on a daily basis. Social media, you know, to a lesser extent, even conversations like this are contribute to this. And that's why it's important that we be aware of those things so that we can try as best as possible to remain balanced between, you know, our intuition and our reason. It's very important.
It's also described as the hyper-real. I forget by who. Mm-hmm. But
That kind of... just as McGilchrist says, like, the map is not the world. No. It's a model of the world. It's not the world. If you think that the map is the world, you're doing it wrong. Yeah. Like, I've got ducks walking around in the backyard. That's the world.
Yeah, that's right.
The map doesn't show the duck, doesn't do the world justice.
Yeah. That's why everybody out there, go have some kids. Play with your kids. That's real. It's the most real thing. To me, at least.
Yep.
Tom, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for doing this on such short notice. I needed this conversation to end the week.
I'm happy to have done it, and I'm glad you reached out, and we'll do it again. And if it helped, good. Great. That's all I can hope for. I had a great time, Marty. Thank you for having me on. It was I learned a lot as always, and I got a chance to go through a lot of stuff, so it's great.
Yeah, well, the pleasure was all mine, as always. Thank you for doing this, and yeah, we'll do it again soon.
Absolutely. Whenever you want. Okay. All right. Thank you, sir.
Peace and love, freaks. Okay.